This is Fresh Air. We paid more and more for movie tickets in the 1980s, but one increase I was happy about was more freshly popped popcorn at theaters. Here to talk about what we actually saw on the screen is Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. He brought his list of the decade's best films, but first let's consider the trends that influenced movie making in the 80s.
There was a period that I called the supply side movies period, in which I think there were a lot of movies that had the traditional Hollywood liberal tone about them, but really were infected by Reaganism, by which I mean movies like Trading Places and Arthur. These are big hit movies in which the little people are celebrated, being at the bottom and still being an okay person is a principle that is celebrated. All this is celebrated as long as you wind up in the end filthy rich. And that, I think, was very characteristic of the Reagan era. That, you know, in 83, after a decade of having a severe recession in this country, we had an economic turnaround. And the joy with which the people in the movie business received that economic turnaround was hard to erase from the movies they were making. And so the happy ending was always just buckets of money being poured down people's gullets. That reflected a kind of strain in the culture that was going on between two impulses, the impulse to be nice to people and the impulse to be very, very nice to oneself.
I found myself this decade seeing a lot of movies I liked, but on the other hand, always bracing myself to be really let down. I know that there's been weekend after weekend during certain slumps where there was just virtually nothing that was really worth seeing. I'd go anyways.
Yeah.
But I'd be let down. Did you find this was often the decade of being let down at the movies?
Well, I felt the middle years of the 80s were ghastly years. And I mean, as what happened in the 80s is that movie making and marketing became very, very sophisticated. It began to rely more and more on things like surveys and test screenings and people juggling with plots, endings, stars, titles, everything else in order to respond to marketing surveys and that sort of thing. And as that happened, movies became less and less interesting. And about the middle of the decade, when people really had the demographics of the movie audience down to a science, which is to say, why make a movie for anyone older than 24 years old or younger than 18, and with less income than this, and with more education than this, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When that happened, you really had just product being pumped out, and the product was bad because it was. I mean, movies have always been this weird combination of commerce and art, and when it becomes too much commerce, the art goes out of it, and suddenly when that happens, the commerce drops out because people just don't want to see these things, you, me, or anyone else.
So you say this was its worst in the mid-80s. Do you feel like we're out of that now?
I do feel like I'm... 89 for me was a very nice year at the movies, and 88 was pretty good, too. I think that the formulas... As I say, there became a moment of diminishing returns. The formulas began to create very bad movies, and when the bad movies started coming out, the formulas no longer worked anymore because no one wants to see bad movies, even if those bad movies are demographically geared to them. A lot of stuff like that is happening now at the end of the decade because people know that finally what makes a good movie is talented movie makers, not prescient marketing surveys.
Well, let's look at some of the trends that affected which movies got made in the 80s. The 80s was an era in which most of the big studios got bought up by other companies, and basically the movies were run by the conglomerates. Do you think that kind of conglomerate-run movie industry has changed the way deals are made and has changed which movies get made?
Well, I think that was what was going on in the mid-80s for a while. I do think that the idea that a movie was a product and that you could market it the way you market Coca-Cola was very much in the spirit of the 80s. And it turned out to be a little bit true and a lot untrue. And that will never disappear, especially as long as there are conglomerates running the movie business. But one has to also keep in mind that the conglomerates now are largely huge entertainment conglomerates. It's not like the days when Transamerica was running movie companies. Time will tell what Sony does to Columbia and TriStar. But the people running Fox are entertainment people. The people running Paramount are largely entertainment people. The people running Disney are entertainment people. These people have come through the industry, through TV, and they have a feeling, not for art, but they at least have a feeling for what goes into, say, telling a story, hiring stars, presenting them to the public. I see that as a somewhat hopeful sign, maybe not a completely hopeful sign, because these people are still nothing like artists. I don't think you're ever going to see an efflorescence like the kind you saw in the early 70s, when suddenly Hollywood was taken over not by an economic theory, but by an artistic theory, that theory being auteurism, and people like Francis Coppola and Martin Scorsese and Brian De Palma and other real directors, real artists, were kind of given their head and were allowed to make the movies they wanted to make. And I think it'll be a very long time before we have an era like that again.
Stephen, I think the 1980s was an interesting decade for England, when we saw a lot of small films about outsiders produced on pretty low budgets. And I'm thinking of Mona Lisa, My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, Comfort and Joy if we expand England into Britain.
Yeah,
well, and this year saw Christy Brown.
Yeah, My Left Foot, absolutely right.
Yeah, My Left Foot, I mean, sorry, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think England really triumphed, and it was a triumph of a kind of system, because almost all those movies came out of their Channel 4. In other words, these were movies made with TV money, subsidized movies made very cheaply and very, very well by people who, I mean, Stephen Frears is kind of a hot commodity now, but he had been making movies for Channel 4 for years and years and years. Your list could go on and on. High Hopes was one of my favorite movies of 89, and that was a movie made by Mike Leigh, who'd been kind of toiling in the vineyards of Channel 4 for years and years and years, for at least the previous decade. And these artists working very, very well within that system with a small budget, but with a constant sort of secure source of money, that should be an example to a lot of film industries.
There have been periods during the 80s where you'd go to the movies and felt that you were watching a deal instead of a film.
Yeah.
How did deal-making change in the 80s?
The one important thing that really happened in the 80s was that the movie stars themselves became production companies, and that gave them even more and more inordinate power. You know, people are always trying to figure out how to make this game a sure thing, and of course it will never be a sure thing, when they hit upon something like a star who seems to attract people to the movie theater, that becomes as close to a sure thing as they have. There are very, very few stars of that sort now, and they're only stars of that sort until they have a flop. It looked like Michael J. Fox was a star of that sort, and then Casualties of War was a flop. And Clint Eastwood was a star of that sort for longer than anyone in history, but his last movie, Pink Cadillac, was a flop. Eddie Murphy looks like a star of that sort now, but, you know, I think his time is due. Tom Cruise proved himself a star of that sort when he made Cocktail, a wretched movie by anyone's standards that still made $70 million. So in terms of making the deal, the star became very, very important, and stars began being able to influence the content of the movie in a way that was never before possible, and to generate movies and to write their own tickets. And now virtually every star of any size has his own production company, which makes deal making very much more complicated. At the same time, what that did was it put a lot of power on the side of the agents, because the agents handled the stars, and then the directors who had become stars in the 70s were also handled by agents. And pretty soon it became possible for agents to say, well, I've got this star director, and I've got this star, and I'm going to put them together, and you the studio can take it or leave it. So that became this famous thing called packaging, and it led to, it used to be that a studio head was the most powerful man in Hollywood. By general agreement, the most powerful man in Hollywood now is Mike Lovitz, the head of the largest agency, CAA.
What about the way movies are sometimes pre-sold? The rights to movies are sometimes pre-sold.
Well, this movement, which had been going on for a long time, hit its height in the 80s with the video boom and the general spread of cable and a kind of burgeoning international market. It became possible for all these markets combined are called the ancillary markets, and it became possible for people to make movies that would play very poorly in American theaters just on the basis of pre-sales to these ancillary markets. The people who were best at this were these crazy guys, Golan and Globus, who ran this company called Canon. And what they would do is they would scratch an idea on a napkin. Let's say they said, E.T. Only Tall. Okay, and that was their idea. And then they said, who could we get who's tall? Who's tall? Clint Eastwood as E.T. Okay, great. And then they would take the idea to Cannes, and they wouldn't talk to anyone who owned E.T., and they wouldn't talk to anyone, and they wouldn't talk to Clint Eastwood. Be advised, this is a very hypothetical example. But they would go to Cannes, and they would meet with representatives from the film market in, say, Senegal, and in Japan, and in Chile. And pretty soon, these people would be saying, yeah, that sounds like a good movie, and I'll put some money into it, and I'll play it in my theater. And pretty soon, they'd have enough money to actually go back to us, to Clint Eastwood, say, or the makers of E.T., and say, look, I've got all this money committed. Why don't we make the movie? A lot of really bad movies happen that way.
Name one.
There were lots of movies. Well, the most amazing project was Jean-Luc Godard's King Lear, which did wind up being a very bad movie, although not as bad as it might have been if it had gone by its original plan, which was to star Norman Mailer as King Lear. It was a mad project, and it ended up doing no one any good. But that was the kind of project that resulted. And the other thing that resulted was a slew of just unspeakable little horror movies that never would have played in a theater near you, but they had to in order to get the right video deal. In other words, they had to get one review, someone saying, scared the pants off me, then they sell it on that basis to a video company, and it goes straight to your video store.
Now, is this pre-sale of international rights still operating at the same level it was in the mid-80s?
Maybe not as insane and maybe not as open, but yes, it's definitely still operating at a very high level.
There was a period in the first part of the 1980s that was like the Porky's scare. Every movie seemed to be a teen movie that was loosely based on Porky's. how did we get out of that? It seems that the movie industry isn't as teen-driven as it was in the first part of the decade.
No, that's absolutely right. That was a result of the sophistication of marketing surveys. People realized that it was sort of, yes, grown-ups go to the movies, and you know, 40-year-old and 50-year-old people go to the movies, but not very many of them compared with the number of teenagers who go to the movies. So why bother making a film for a tiny market when you can make a film for a large market, and it can be dumb? You know, you don't have to have high-priced talent. You don't have to have stars. You don't have to work very hard on it. You can make it fast. You can make it cheap. It can look no better than TV, and it'll be as big a hit as Porky's. And later on, there became these sort of maestros of that kind of filmmaking. I'm thinking of John Hughes, you know, who almost raised it to an art form, although it was not an art form that I appreciated very much. I mean, Ferris Bueller's Day Off was one of the top 10 grossers in more ways than one of its year, and that was scary for a lot of us out there. And we spent, you know, 5 or 6 years watching the teen movies trundle in and trundle out. And then they stopped attracting kids. They pandered a great deal. They were very repetitive. There was this peak year where Back to School and Ferris Bueller's Day Off were both in the top 10, and that was, you know, that was a very ugly year for a lot of us. And then even the teens seemed to get tired of them. I mean, every movie would begin in high school, and the rivalries were always the same. And with each new attempt, the sort of psychological penetration would seem less and less. There was a backlash, and I think it's sort of a sad thing. One of my favorite movies of 1989 is a movie called Say Anything, which is a teen romance, and I think it's better than The Graduate and has a kind of similar structure. It was dismissed out of hand as yet another teen romance. It's not yet another teen romance. It's a very good movie. Another movie at the beginning of the year called Heathers, which I thought was very provocative and interesting, covering the same ground, was a fresh take on it and was not ignored, but I think given a different background, would have gotten a more serious kind of attention.
This is really the first decade that home video has had a really big effect on how people see movies, when they see movies. Do you think that home video has affected either which movies get produced theatrically or the aesthetics by which they're produced? Do you think that film directors are thinking ahead to how the movies are going to play when they're shrunk down to home video?
Well, you know, when at the beginning of this home video era, we all thought that something like that would happen. We thought, what's it going to mean when you want to see a movie 10 times when you own the movie. What's that going to mean for film aesthetics? Mostly, though, the video revolution turned into rentals. I think the way home video really influenced movie making was as an ancillary market, as a place where you could pre-sell the movie, where you could know that you were going to make money, even if the movie was bad, even if the movie didn't do well in theaters. And largely the effect was it created a lot more product. There's a lot of bad movie making out there that will find its way directly to video without ever passing by your eyes or mine.
Well, I think it's time, Stephen, to read your list of the top films of the 1980s.
Well, what a pleasure that will be.
Drum roll, please.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's a long decade, and I couldn't do 10, so I did 15.
Well, we'll let you get away with it this time.
Thank you so much. And now, these are in alphabetical order, but I do have a favorite. So I'll take that one out of alphabetical order and save it for last.
Okay.
Okay. Otherwise, in alphabetical order, the top 15, A Nos Amours by Maurice Pialat, Atlantic City, Louis Malle, Blowout, Brian De Palma, Blue Velvet, David Lynch, Diner, Barry Levinson, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg, Melvin and Howard, Jonathan Demme, Monty Python's The Meaning of Life by Terry Jones and everybody else, Pichote by Hector Bibenco, Pritzi's Honor, John Huston, Shoot the Moon, Alan Parker, The Fly, David Cronenberg, Tootsie, Sidney Pollack, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, Pedro Almodovar, and my favorite movie of the 80s, The Night of the Shooting Stars by the Taviani Brothers.
Now, what do these movies, your choices for the best films of the 1980s, what do they have to say about the trends and patterns that you've been discussing? Do they relate to them at all?
Well, I think it's characteristic of a great movie to be either the culmination of a trend so much so that it supersedes all trends, or to be way outside the loop.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these, I think, are outside the loop. The trends of the 80s were so deadening on the whole, were so formulaic, were so kind of corporate driven instead of artistically driven, that these movies sort of had to escape that kind of trend area. I think that gives them a sort of power. They're fresh, they're alive, they're new, they're different. They turned a lot of heads, including mine.
Well, Stephen Schiff, I wish you a very happy new year.
Well, the same to you, Terry.
And thanks for talking with us about movies of the 80s. Thank
Great
you.
Pleasure.
Stephen Schiff is film critic for Fresh Air and critic at large for Vanity Fair.